The House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law is in session.
There's just some minor changes
in the agenda this morning that I'd like to announce. With respect to House Bill 3303, that will be set over till Wednesday for a work session to allow PERS to submit an amendment. That's already been pre-discussed with the chair and with the PERS representative. As to House Bill 2269, we're in a work session. We'll be invited testimony from ODOT, from Dennis Weigel, and John Giel. And with that, I think we'll proceed right straight through the agenda. On the first bill, House Bill 2146, I'll open a public hearing and ask counsel to explain the bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, you have before you dash four amendments for this bill. Those amendments don't change the bill too much in substance. They do change the procedure, however, of how DHS goes about recovering monies from third parties who owe monies. This is a bill that comes to you from the DHS. Like I said, the dash four amendments require recipients of services from the from DHS to execute an assignment of rights to the DHS for any claims for payment for medical care from a third party. They require recipients to cooperate with the DHS to pursue third parties who may be liable for care and services. Require DHS to provide notice indicating that DHS is or will be asserting a claim against a third party. And it clarifies that recipients' rights to bring claims are not restricted by the assignment to the DHS.
Thank you. I have nine witnesses on this bill, and I'm going to try to call you in panels, calling the proponents first, as I understand this sign-up sheet. So, Roy Fredericks from DHS, Gretchen Merrill from DOJ, and Carl Goodwin from DOJ. Would you like to come forward, please? Morning.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roy Fredericks, State Administration and Personal Injury Liens Manager, Administrative Services for the Department of Human Services. I am here today testifying in support of the Dash 4 Amendment to HB 2146. This bill was pre-session filed by the Department of Human Services and provides that as a condition of eligibility, a recipient of public assistance must assign their rights to DHS to a claim for payment from a third party for the amount of public assistance provided by the state related to an accident or injury sustained by the client. This reflects the federal mandate for clients to assign their rights to state agencies so that the state agency may request payment from liable third parties. 42 U.S.C. 1396 AA 25H requires that a state, quote, have in effect laws which, to the extent that payment has been made under the state plan for medical assistance for health care items or services furnished to an individual, the state is considered to have acquired the rights of such individual to payment by any other party for such health care items or services, end quote. This bill codifies federal law and will increase recoveries of public assistance. The Personal Injury Liens Unit of DHS currently has authority under Oregon law to impose a lien on the proceeds of any third-party action brought by the recipient for the cost of accident-related public assistance, but it has no authority to present its claim to a liable third party when the client cannot or chooses not to take action. As mentioned, the Department of Human Services needs this legislation to implement a mandatory provision of Medicaid law. This bill is needed in cases where a Medicaid recipient is injured in an automobile accident caused by a third party's negligence. Often the state may pay the medical bills associated with the injury. However, the Medicaid recipient may elect not to pursue any legal claim against the liable third party, preventing the state from filing a lien and being reimbursed for the cost of medical assistance it has provided. Effectively, in such an example, the cost of accident-related medical assistance has been shifted from the liable third party to the state. when a Medicaid recipient has been driving uninsured or under the influence of intoxicants, ORS 31.715 specifically precludes a person uninsured or under the influence from recovering non-economic damages, such as pain and suffering, even if the accident was not their fault. Consequently, there is little financial incentive for the Medicaid recipient to pursue a claim against the third party, since most of the proceeds of any award from the court would have to go to the state to reimburse for the medical assistance that was provided. In summary, this bill will increase the recovery of public assistance and bring the Department of Human Services into compliance with federal law. It outlines a process whereby the department may provide notice of its claim with a liable third party. And finally, nothing in the bill prohibits a recipient from recovering damages from a liable third party except for that portion of the claim that is for medical care for which an assignment was made. We understand that today some managed care plans under contract with the state have expressed a desire to amend our bill to allow them to file an action against a third party directly, to recover the amount of accident-related medical assistance they have provided to our client. However, the department, based on legal advice from the Department of Justice, cannot support such a change. Although we understand that their request is well-intentioned, such a change would provide powers to a contractual agent that is not envisioned under the federal law and would exceed the authority of any existing contractual agreement with the plans. Since the time the managed care plan submitted their request, the bill has been revised to track the federal statute and allow solely for the assignment of health benefits as a condition of eligibility. With me today to answer any technical questions you may have about the bill are Carl Goodman of the Department of Justice and Gretchen Merrill of the Department of Justice.
Thank you for your testimony. You folks want to testify, you have an opportunity to, or you're just here to answer questions? I didn't know what your last comment meant, if they were just here to answer questions or testify, but they want to testify, now's the time.
I think they're primarily here to answer any questions you may have and provide any technical assistance.
All right, I do have several, but I'll defer to the committee first. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, is there a fiscal idea of the effect this will have?
I think when we did the fiscal analysis, we anticipated the first year would be a minimum of $100,000, and then once we got it going, probably $40,000 a month thereafter.
Plus or minus?
Plus.
Okay. I was assuming that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? I just might note that we're proceeding this morning in the public hearing. We don't have a quorum for a work session, but if we do, we'll try to come back and try to accommodate your needs. I just need some questions answered that are definitional. On the original bill, you just mentioned the ability to do a third-party claim to collect what was denoted as assistance. I thought that was general assistance. Did you intend in the original bill to include medical expenses as well?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Now, is there any reason why you're not also pursuing general assistance in the Dash 3 or Dash 4 amendments?
I believe when that was drafted by legislative counsel, I think they used the term medical assistance, but medical assistance, I believe the definition is broad enough to cover also general assistance. We can clarify that for you, Chair Ackerman.
Right. Let me just refer to the Dash 4 because the way I read it, as a condition of eligibility for assistance, the assignment would be executed for rights to a claim for payment for medical care. I think going from the general to the specific, that could be interpreted that you're only asking for third-party litigation rights for medical care rather than for general assistance. And I need to know what you intended, because if you wanted intended the broader general assistance classification, then I think we need an amendment to be sure what we're doing.
Well, I think the bill was modified to reflect medical care, because that mirrors some of the language used in the federal statute. But I think under the Oregon statute, if I'm correct, Chair Ackerman, the definition of medical assistance is fairly broad and does in fact cover general assistance.
My problem is that it doesn't say that in the bill, and I'm afraid that court to do otherwise and undo hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of third-party claims. It would be best, in my opinion, to have a clarifying amendment. We have your resource persons. What do they feel about that?
Carl, Gretchen?
Well, I think, Chair Ackerman, the definition of medical assistance in Chapter 416 is broad enough to include all types of assistance, including general assistance, that the state would be recovering under these cases.
Okay. Do you have that citation?
I don't have the 416 statutes in front of me, but
okay.
We can certainly get that to you, Chair Ackerman.
I think we should. As I said, I don't want to play fast or loose with definitions, because you and I know the courts are just going to read the black letter law, and if they say medical assistance and you try to say that's general assistance, we have a definitional problem, and you're going to have some litigation. I know that. President McPherson,
I have some question, separate one, Mr. Chair, but I guess that the line of question you were pursuing raised a question in my mind. What we're dealing with here are third parties who are liable, and what I'm visualizing, and I'd like Mr. Frederick to confirm this, is that this is a the ordinary situation would be some third party who, in an act of negligence, causes injury to somebody who's getting medical assistance under the Oregon Health Plan, and this is an opportunity for DHS to pursue that claim for medical damages against that third party because the medical care was provided for by the state. And I guess I'm lost as to why general assistance would come into play.
Because the injured party might be on general assistance, and I think you have lien rights with respect to that situation. So, am I not right?
That's correct, Chair Ackerman. Representative McPherson, could have someone in an accident that ended up basically needing, let's say, care in a foster home for a period of time until they recovered from their injuries. That would generally be under medical assistance, even though it was a payment specific to a foster home provider, a cash grant payment.
What about the recipient that's receiving general assistance receives from, I thought there was a method by which the department could file a lien on that.
There is. Chair Ackerman, there is. If the individual subsequently files a claim for damages against a third party, carrier, a liable third party.
Yeah, I'm making sure I understand what assistance is. She's receiving a check because she, in this case, has a child, minor child at home on welfare, so to speak. I know you can collect a portion of that through your lien rights.
That's correct, Chair Ackerman.
And I'm denominating that separate from medical assistance.
That's right, but it's related to the accident.
Everything relates to the accident.
Right.
I'm just trying to get back to the definitional problem and answer Representative McPherson's question about you can be on general assistance and you can still seek recovery of a certain amount of that assistance. I've forgotten what the formula is right now.
That's correct, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the key issues in the parallel situation under private health plans is the compensation for counsel who pursues recovery from a third party, and usually in that context there's a private attorney who has been engaged by the injured party to pursue a personal injury claim, and then the part of that recovery is something that then the provider, in this case the state, DHS, of health coverage would be seeking a piece of, and the right to a share of that recovery by the counsel who's representing the injured party is oftentimes a key issue. I don't see, aside from a reference in the original bill that I don't see in the -4 amendments to the department recovering attorney's fees and court costs, I don't see anything here that addresses that issue. Is it contemplated that in all cases It would be the state through DOJ or through another other department counsel who would be pursuing the recovery rather than coordinating with counsel to the injured party.
This bill is specifically Representative McPherson designed to address the assignment issue and allow us to go to a third party and present our claim, and it's specific to instances where the individual, for whatever reason, chooses not to engage private counsel to assist them in filing a claim.
Follow up if I could?
No.
Then is it, so you wouldn't use this authority in the case where there's an injury and there that for which injured party is being represented by other counsel, would you pursue a recovery through coordination with that effort but not using this authority?
Carl, you want to mention?
Representative McPherson, in that situation, the state would rely on its lien authority. If the client actually brought a suit, was taking action on its own to bring an action, the state would file its loss its lien under Chapter 416, 540. This bill is just intended to catch the situations where the client, for whatever reason, doesn't bring an action on his own.
The statute you referenced is a lien on the proceeds of that other recovery.
That's correct, Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Another technical type of question. I assume that within the department you have your third-party claim people that process these cases administratively, but when it reaches a point of either threatening litigation or getting into filing the third-party claim, you then would obtain what the services of DOJ, and how would you be charged for that?
Well, ordinarily, this bill is designed basically to allow us, give us the statutory authority to present our claim, and we're assuming that, you know, in 98% of the cases, we're going to get a positive response from the third-party insurance carrier. You know, it's not designed, the intent here is not to establish under this language an opportunity for us to take a direct action against a third party.
But that's what it does, doesn't it?
Not
you're extending your rights against a third party from lien rights to actually filing the claim. And my point is, at what point do you engage legal services, and what does that cost the department?
Well, if we moved in that direction, I think we'd have to look at it from a department perspective to see if it was cost-effective to the department. If it was a relatively small amount, then obviously it wouldn't be appropriate probably for us to engage Department of Justice to get involved. If it was a larger amount, then I guess we'd have to weigh the circumstances. But we don't anticipate that that'll, you know, be necessary very often, if at all.
But my point, again, the question was, when that event does occur, you engage DOJ for legal services, and what is the department charged?
What does the department charge? They charge DHS, I think the going rate for an hour of Attorney General time is $95 an hour.
Okay, fine. I just want to make that point. Thank you. I have another question, too. And this involves a situation where you take the assignment and you settle on the reimbursement for, say, medical costs. The recipient then engages counsel and files a claim against the third party and includes in that claim not medical costs because those have been reimbursed, but a claim for pain and suffering. Is he or she barred by the doctrine of claim preclusion from pursuing that case? I'm using a technical term, but I know you have counsel with you.
Chair Ackerman, I believe that the situation is that that individual would not be barred because the claim that is being made is for DHS's costs, not the individual's. And any claim that DHS may bring, first of all, we don't anticipate it being an actual claim that's brought into court and that is then litigated and could be arguably precluded. So I don't anticipate that that would happen at all. If at all, it would be very few cases. And secondly, again, it is the state's claim for these services provided, and is separate and apart from any pain and suffering claim. And frankly, the purpose of this is these will mostly be smaller claims. Where an individual truly has enough of a claim that they have pain and suffering, economic damages, anything large enough in order to bring a claim, it's most likely they will obtain their own counsel and bring a lawsuit, and we'll just sit in on our lien rights.
Well, I'm just concerned about the rights of the recipient under my hypothetical that may be barred, and I know that you say you don't intend that, but it would not take very much thought for a prudent insurance defense counsel to raise that motion, file a motion to dismiss on the basis of claim preclusion because they've already paid the claim. And I don't want to leave the third party, the recipients hanging out like that, so I wanted to understand what the bill does or doesn't do. And what I may ask when we conclude the hearing today is that maybe we amend this to put in some language so that that defense is not available to the insurer for third-party people, just to more adequately protect the rights of the public. I'm just sort of thinking out loud right now, but I'm worried about the issue. I don't know the answer. I can certainly ask counsel for an opinion on that, and maybe that's where we should go to.
Well, Representative Ackerman, I agree with you, and that was the purpose of subsection 4, which doesn't limit the right, and that was the intent, is that absolutely we do not want to limit their rights to bring any other lawsuit to recover costs other than the actual costs that they weren't out of pocket anyway. And so that's what's intended with subsection 4, but I'm sure we can tweak that language to make it a more obvious intent that we do not wish to have that barred at all.
Yes, that was called to my attention, discussion of the bill with some other folks, that was probably the intent, but we could probably make it a little more clear. I mean, I know it's a section. This does not limit the right of the applicant to bring a claim, but it doesn't bar the defense of claim preclusion as sufficiently as I would like to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking of what the courts will do. I'm also trying to think what defense counsel will do too. Okay, let me see if I have any other questions. President Flores is here. Do you have any questions of the witnesses?
No, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, further statements from the panel?
I think we've pretty much presented our position on the case. This is a revenue generator, and we're hopeful that this, once again, this also would bring us into compliance with federal law. So we hope the committee will provide positive consideration for our bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just stay with us till we finish the hearing. We may want to call you back.
Thank you.
Okay, then the next panel, Sybil Hebb and Lauren Rhodes, would like to come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent over 500 providers of long-term care services in the state of Oregon, including nursing facilities, assisted living and residential care facilities, and in-home care agencies. We are here to testify today neither in support nor opposition to this bill, but merely to reflect many conversations that we have had with both officials of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice regarding the intention behind this bill. And based on Mr. Frederick's testimony, we understand that this is merely to bring the state into compliance with federal law, and we have no trouble with that, obviously. What we do want the record to reflect today is that this is a bill that allows the state only to pursue parties that actually have legal liability for the claims of medical assistance that the state is seeking, rather than a fishing expedition of potentially liable parties. The federal law to which they reference, 42 U.S.C. 1396A, A25H, makes several references to legally liable parties, and it's our understanding that that would be a party who has been actually adjudicated liable for the payments to which the state seeks recovery. So that's our understanding of the bill, and the amendments, I believe, reflect that at this point, and we just wanted to make it clear that that was our position on the bill. I'm happy to take any questions or answer any concerns the committee might have.
Thank you.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb, lobbyist for the Oregon Law Center, and our firm is a statewide firm representing low-income Oregonians in civil matters. Many of our clients are recipients of public assistance, and so our concern about this bill comes from the position, the perspective of the recipient who is assigning his or her claim to the Department of Human Services. And I just wanted to make it clear that we don't have any objection to that principle, and we do agree that that is provided for in federal law and are supportive of implementing that in the state law. We just have a couple of concerns about how that may play out, one of which is that we share the concern that Representative Ackerman you raised with respect to claim preclusion, and I can't claim to be an expert about claim preclusion, unfortunately, but I do respect that the intent of subsection 4 is to make it clear that individuals still have the right to pursue other claims against the third party for reimbursement for expenses that may not have been covered by the Department of Human Services, but want to make very sure that there's no question about the fact that that right is preserved. The other concern I wanted to raise for the committee is that in line 14 of the Dash 4 amendments, that's the last sentence of paragraph 2 of section 2, and that speaks about the recipient's requirement, the requirement that the recipient cooperate with the Department of Human Services in the pursuit of the claim. And the last section says that requirement exists unless the recipient, there's good cause for the recipient not to cooperate. And I want to make sure that good cause definition, when it gets to the rulemaking stage, includes considerations related to the best interests of the parties. That term is reflected and used in the federal law, and so I hope that the state will adopt similar rules so that the best interests of the parties can be considered in whether or not they're allowed or they're required to cooperate. And for just a brief example to illustrate my concern is, for example, if there's a car accident, it was the fault of the husband and the wife is injured, is the wife going to be cooperating in a lawsuit against the husband, and are there considerations there that should be taken into account in terms of the best interests of the family? And it's specifically a concern if there are any domestic violence or other physical safety concerns that may be at play. So I just wanted to raise those for the committee's consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about those.
Testimony. Are there questions from the committee? I just may have one on the good cause requirement. I understand your concern. The department has rulemaking authority. Would you rather address the issue there, or would you rather deal with it in terms of a another amendment to the bill? Because we're going to have an opportunity to do the latter. So.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. I think it's frankly our preference would be to have some specific direction that the department consider the best interests of the parties when making the rules, and we believe that is currently a part of the federal law, and so it should be an easy standard to put into the statute. I don't think there's a need in this the statute in Oregon statute to specifically define all the circumstances which might rise to the level of the best interest of the parties, but I would like that direction.
Okay, I just want to get what your direction was, because it appears to me we're going to have some clarifying amendments at the bare minimum, and so you'd be included within that work group, surely.
I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have three more people on my list, and I can't tell whether you're for the bill or against the bill. I think I'll just call you up all at once and sort it out. Clint Simpson, Chantel Wires, and Rod Dixon. Come forward, and I call
Donna Alexander.
And Donna Alexander, that's correct. I had four. I misread that. Please come forward. Are any of you in favor of the bill? If so, the proponents get to go first and let me know who that is. Okay. Okay, looks like you're all against the bill, so again, you can proceed in any...
I didn't hear your question.
Oh, are any of you in favor of the bill? If so, you get to go first.
In favor of the bill? Well, that sort of depends.
Representative Ackerman, I think everyone at the table is in favor of the bill as amended, if it can be amended to accommodate our interests.
Okay. Then I'll let you proceed in any manner you wish to this morning.
Why don't I start?
Sure,
Members of the committee, my name is Clint Simpson. I'm an attorney in Eugene. I represent a number of Oregon health plan contractors in the state. In my written testimony, I've listed the eight groups that my firm currently represents. We are in favor of the bill 2146, either in its original form or in the amendment that was put out by DHS late last week, so long as it is passed or amended further to include the Oregon health plan contractor groups. And let me take just a minute to explain to you what these groups do and how the system is structured. Under the Oregon Health Plan, when it was set up by the legislature, a statute was included which allows the Department of Human Services to contract out members to different groups for processing of Oregon Health Plan benefits. And pursuant to that statutory provision, DHS has entered into contract with 10, 12, somewhere around there, a number of groups throughout the state of Oregon. In Eugene, we have LIPA, which is the Lane Individual Practice Association. In Portland area, we have Care Oregon and Family Care. In Salem here, we have the Marion Polk Community Health Plan. In Roseburg, we have the Douglas County Individual Practice Association. And each geographic area of the state has a group, and these are private corporations or limited liability corporate groups. And they're all under contract with the state of Oregon. And the way it works is that when a member applies for health plan assistance, DHS will either provide the medical assistance themselves, as Mr. Fredericks was talking about here a few minutes ago, or, which is more common, they will assign the member to one of the OHP contractors in the various geographic areas. And looking at the latest data from the DHS website, it appears that approximately three-fourths of all OHP-eligible members are assigned out to the various Oregon Health Plan contractors in the state. Now, as I indicated in our written materials that I submitted, the Oregon Health Plan contractors are also under a mandate to pursue third-party recoveries. And this comes through the federal law as well as the terms of the contract that the DHS enters into with these various groups. There are specific provisions that require that my clients pursue third-party resources. And it is our position that under the original form of the bill, if there is a direct action given to DHS, that direct action right should also be given to their agents, the OHP contractors. It's our position that in the amended form of the bill, in which DHS is simply seeking an assignment, statutory assignment, of the member's rights to sue for medical bills, it's our position that if that member is assigned to one of the OHP contractors, then the OHP contractor should receive that assignment and thereby be able to pursue direct reimbursement against the responsible party. It's our view that DHS and the OHP contractors are or should be essentially on the same side in this matter. We are both looking for ways to maximize the recovery of third-party resources, which will have the effect of improving the financial status of the Oregon Health Plan and making benefits available for more people in the long term. So I have with me representatives from three of the groups who will make their own statements, but it's our position that either amendment is fine as long as the bill includes our groups to give us the same rights to pursue these claims.
Testimony from the other members at the table? Sure. Any of you prepared? Yes, go ahead and identify yourself for the record, please.
Rod Dixon, Douglas County IPA. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, as indicated, I do represent the Douglas County IPA. I've been employed by them for approximately 10 years. The Douglas County IPA is under contract with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs to provide health care coverage for Oregon Health Plan recipients in Douglas County. Currently, we insure approximately 10,500 OHP recipients. I'm here today to let you know that we support the amended version of House Bill 2146. Now, DSIPA is required in our contract with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs to pursue recovery in matters involving third-party liability. And over the years, DSIPA has sought recoveries from third parties under what we might call a common law subrogation theory. And while this has worked well in the majority of cases, we occasionally encounter liability carriers who refuse to reimburse us directly. Instead, they try to force us to seek recovery through the member's attorney. And we also experience conflict with plaintiff attorneys who don't want to reimburse us for the full amount we've paid for the Medicaid services provided. Now, if House Bill 2146 is amended to include prepaid healthcare service organizations such as DSIPA, and if it becomes Oregon law, then this will give us a statutory basis for pursuing the negligent third party. Ultimately, amending HB 2146 as proposed would increase the number of cases where prepaid healthcare service organizations such as DSIPA, LIPA, where we'd be able to recover full reimbursement. We believe it's in the best interest of all of us to recover as much taxpayer dollars as we can from third-party resources. And this action not only satisfies a federal mandate to do so, but it frees up resources to provide benefits to others. And I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. We have two more people at the...
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I have my 15 copies. Do you want them after?
Yes, we can pass those out. And state your name for the record first, please.
My name is Donna Alexander. I'm the third-party recovery manager for Marion Polk Community Health Plan. I've been in that position since May of 2001. Prior to working for MIPCHIP, I worked at Regents in their third-party recovery department as well. I have chaired a quarterly third-party recovery work group meeting since August of 2003 that includes fully capitated health plans as well as key people at LMAP with regards to third-party recovery. As a work group, we try to come up with solutions and problems to problems as well as attempting to help each other to get the best recoveries possible within the scope of the rules and laws and contracts that we're required. I am somewhat of a sounding board for third-party questions and issues the plans have. For this reason, I feel like I have a good understanding of the third-party recovery process as it relates to Medicaid rules and OMAP guidelines. Because of my experience at Regents, I'm also aware of how much harder it is to administer a third-party recovery program within the constraints of a government program as opposed to a commercial health plan. There are a few problems we encounter regularly for which the House Bill 2146 may help to improve. Our members are supposed to assist us in our efforts to recover, but there are no consequences if they don't. We do have the ability to file a lien, but the guidelines are time-consuming and red tape prevents us from getting the liens before settlements happen. Once the money's been dispersed, we have little or no hope for getting any kind of monies back.
There is a law that prevents a person from suing for pain and suffering if they were driving without insurance, or I think the way that it's stated is if they're committing a crime, so uninsured or drunk driving, then they can't sue for pain and suffering. So this deters members from pursuing a case against an adverse carrier because there's really no benefit for them doing so. Many of our members also do not pursue third-party cases because they can't afford an attorney and or the attorneys don't want to take their case because maybe it's a small settlement and they, you know, are looking for the big money, I guess. This House bill is a good idea and will help in those few cases where either the member or the attorneys aren't cooperative. As a fully capitated health plan, we are bound by the same rules, laws, and guidelines as any Medicaid plan, and our funding comes from the same place. I do not see any conflict of interest in allowing us the same provisions as OMAP has. The bottom line is not to pay for claims that someone else is responsible for. Our contract states we must take all reasonable actions to pursue third-party recovery for services provided. Commercial health plans base their rates and keep their costs down by not paying for claims that another entity is responsible for, and our insurance premium would be considerably higher if our health insurance companies were paying for auto work and other injuries that someone else is responsible for. I don't understand why Medicaid would be any different. We're using taxpayer money to fund the plan, so shouldn't we try? Shouldn't we try hard to make sure that we aren't paying for something someone else is responsible for? This bill provides us the opportunity to get our recoveries and not on the back of the members or the providers, which is always our concern. We don't want to make someone have to pay for something that they're not responsible for. This puts the responsibility on the entity that is responsible. And thank you for your time. That's it.
Fine, thank you. Further testimony from the panel?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Chairman Ackerman and committee members, I'm Chantel Wires and I represent the Lane Individual Practice Association in Eugene, LIPA. We provide services for over 29,000 members in the area and in contiguous areas. We have the same assignment of rights and the same mandate to pursue third parties as DHS. The potential to recover more dollars from third parties and direct it back into the Oregon Health Plan is an assured way of providing more services and or benefits for our members. All too often, we have seen recoveries being absorbed by other interests when the monies could have helped the very people whom we are serving and need the services most. Whether the benefits are provided to Oregonians by DHS or the OHP contractors, we are looking at the same source of money. Historically, OHP and DHS have had problems in pursuing and securing third-party recovery. Both are required to take all reasonable actions to pursue third-party resources and would benefit from this direct action that House Bill 2146 would allow. I see this as a win-win situation for all. I don't see the downside, and I don't understand why the OHP contractors would not be included in this House bill. And I thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. If you just sit here for a moment, we'll see if we have any questions from the committee. None to my right, none to my left. Okay, let me sort of try something. Testimony before me from the Oregon Health Care Association. Which one of you represents the Oregon Health Care Association? None of you? Way in the back. Okay. I have a question that I'll address to you later on, which I can deal with. Any other questions of the committee? I assume that you believe that there's some efficiencies in allowing the managed health care, the local managed health care entities to pursue these third-party claims. Could you explain what that might be? I mean, if our choices are it all goes to DHS or there's some method by which you can allocate these cases, maybe through a subassignment or some other authority, do you see any alternatives to be more efficient if you were able to pursue some of the claims since you're handling 75% of the caseload?
Well, I'm not, Representative Ackerman, I'm not sure if this directly answers your question. I'll try. The system as it's set up works fine with the contracts being sent out by DHS for different groups and entities to provide the benefits. The problem is that under the current state of the law, in order to pursue third-party recoveries from negligent parties, we have to rely on what is called common law subrogation rights. And under the common law, for non-lawyers on the panel, that means that when the health plan pays medical benefits, they acquire the rights or step into the shoes of the member and acquire the right to sue the third party. That's a very good doctrine, but it doesn't pack the wallop that a statutory assignment does, which is what DHS is proposing under this. We'll have it be much more efficient and much more successful in pursuing reimbursement claims if we have the statutory authority that this bill provides. It will tell liability carriers that they need to reimburse us or they face the possibility of a direct action. It will allow us to effectively pursue claims where the member does not have an attorney, where the member has no claim for non-economic damages and decides not to pursue the case on their own. It'll simply be another tool for our box which will allow us to effectively or maximize the recoveries that we can obtain.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee? And there are none, so thank you very much for being here this morning. And I just have a few more things to cover in the public hearing. I'll ask Ms. Rhodes to come back for a moment. I just want to make sure I understand part of your testimony, please. Was there somebody else who wanted to testify? You came late. That's okay. Why don't you come to the front table then? You're right on time, really. We're running late, so it accommodates you. Are you handing out testimony?
No.
And are you in favor or opposed to the bill or neutral?
No, I need to give you a little testimony verbally.
Excuse me?
I need to give you some verbal testimony on this bill.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. Do you want her to go first?
Well, I have just one question to ask of Ms. Rhodes, and then we'll give you the time that you need. In your letter or your testimony, you cite the statute and say that you read it to limit the state's authority to collect from a third party who has, quote, legal liability, close quotes, to make a payment. We want the legislative record to reflect that this bill is limited in scope and does not permit the state to engage in fishing expeditions in search of potentially liable third parties. I need to know what you mean by that.
Mr. Chair, Lauren Rhodes, Oregon Healthcare Association. It is our understanding in the references within the federal law that the intention behind the law is to collect from legally liable parties. What the original bill in its original state merely referenced parties who may be liable. And our concerns stemmed from this vague and somewhat ambiguous reference to potentially liable parties is how we read it. And subsequently, with assistance from your counsel, we met with DHS and their attorneys to determined that it isn't their intention to merely search for any party that could be liable, but rather limit it to the federal references to parties who are legally liable, meaning it is our understanding that's a party who has been adjudicated liable, to which we would be concerned that DHS would be simply going after any healthcare provider who may or may not have been liable for the party's injuries or but rather somebody who actually has been proven to be legally liable.
How is that determination made if you're looking at a little file and there's a question as to, say, in a motor vehicle accident, whether the third party third party, you know, ran the red light or didn't run the red light. Do you feel that that is just something that, well, we won't pursue that case because we can't establish it conclusively and do no investigation? Or do you think you're under the statutes have a duty to investigate to see if liability can be determined?
Mr. Chair, our concern would be with residents who reside in our facilities who are under the financial care of the Oregon Health Plan, not the motor vehicle situation to which DHS makes reference to. So, with all intents and purposes, this bill would limit their scope in these more general situations as opposed to a resident who's residing in a long-term care facility. But we just wanted to ensure that it didn't become a broad fishing expedition for the department to recover money that they believe they are owed.
I guess my problem with that is a fishing expedition is, you know, on one hand, maybe someone else's ability to investigate and negotiate a claim on another. So I, you know, some claims are disputed and are settled for substantially less than the full face value. And looking at it from a state policy point of view to reimburse the health plan and indirectly the general fund, it would seem to me that we want you know, fairly aggressive collection of a third or a pursuit of these claims, which would include investigation and negotiation.
And Mr. Chair, absolutely. We entirely support that concept. But we just want to make sure that they are pursuing parties who have established legal liability, just simply in compliance with the federal law. That's all we're after.
Well, I just want to make sure our legislative record here is complete because you have an interpretation of the statute, which is obviously yours, and but the wording of the statute is not set out, so I just want to make sure that legislative record is clear that we're not making any definitive decision on your point.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We entirely understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to clarify that. Ma'am, would you, you're on next.
My name's Teresa Teeter. I'm from Oregon City, Oregon, Clackamas County. I was a recipient of the Oregon Health Plan until January this year, and I've just recently filed two lawsuits in federal court naming 11 defendants from the governor on down, including your OMAP office, your OHP office, on this issue that you're talking about today. The issue of the first couple sentences, I looked at the gentleman's thing. I don't think we should have to sign away our rights to recovery if the state is a party to any collection. I put it right in my lawsuit that the state of Oregon, I have evidence, is culpable in the damages that happened to me while receiving OHP services contracted out through your OMAP office. And I put it in both lawsuits. And it all started with you guys letting Pfizer into this state with their off-label drug, Neurontin. So if you want to go after anything from this dude to get your money back, that's fine with me, but you're not going to do it through my lawsuit because I came to you folks and told you over and over that they were off-labeling me, that they were submitting false claims for payment through Medicaid in this state. I went to DHS. I went to OMAP. I went to everybody in this state, from the governor's office down, and every one of you covered up, so you don't care about Medicaid fraud in this state. So for you to put this in a bill that you're going to go after any money I collect, you need to hire your own lawyers to go after all these people, do your own investigations, because you're not going to get it out of my hard efforts to get this law through court. It's a given. It's assigned. I have 11 defendants on this one and one on this one, and I have two judges that aren't ready to retire. So the thing that that lady said back there, I can't remember the terminology she used, but you need to put that in there, because if you're a third party but you're culpable to this, then you don't have any, in my opinion, rights to collect on damages done to me through your own state agencies that you contracted, through county agencies, etc. I'm very peeved about this. I had suicide attempts on four off-label drugs at the same time, all for post-traumatic stress from 1999 up until this year. It involves contract of a shelter plus care contract that was altered, and your DHS person down there down the street has all the tort claim notices from me regarding all these allegations. So before you start trying to jump on the constituents here about signing away legal authority for you to collect damages. You better look where the damages lie, because I've been in your face since 2003, and this is not going to happen in the state of Oregon to me or anybody else, and I'm not signing on a dotted line for any state program anymore that says you can come get. I got more letters in the mail from you folks when I fell down while on these medications and busted my knees and my elbows through Willamette Falls Hospital and say, well, if you're going to pursue this thing that happened to you on city property, blah, 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 the state wants their money back. Well, you allowed this product into this state. You allowed this to happen to me, and you didn't do anything, and I testified against pharmaceutical companies, et cetera. So think about where your culpability lies before you start saying, I want my handout back. Okay, thank you very much. And I live at 815 Harrison Street, Oregon City, Oregon.
Let's wait a minute, so we may have some questions for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions from the committee. I want to give them an opportunity. Did you have some testimony that you are handing
out?
No,
it's just a copy of the judicial assignment from the judges. Who's okay. My judges? And they're court clerks.
Okay, fine. I appreciate that.
Thank you
again for your testimony. Anyone else here to testify on this bill? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2146, and I think what I'd like to do, rather than bring us into a work session with some of the issues that are not yet resolved, is to see if the parties could get together. I want to make sure that the managed care people and DHS are represented in the work group to work on the issues that we talked about this morning. And with the committee's consent, let me just isolate those for you. A greater definition of what medical costs are, particularly if they are to include general assistance, the issue of claim preclusion, whether a good cause needs to be specified in the statute or whether we can rely upon rulemaking, and then the allocation of claims through some formula or sub-assignment between DHR and the managed health care people. I think those are the outstanding issues as I see them, having been brought forth to the committee this morning. Is that pretty well understandable? Anybody questions what I'm trying to do? Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could just raise it, based on what the last witness was pointing out, it did raise an issue in my mind about the exclusivity of the assignment. That is, whether the assignment then shifts away from the injured party any right to pursue that claim, which I think is probably the effect. So at least I want people to be focusing on that as well as the other issues you did as to whether that's the appropriate assignment. It may well be that it's an exclusive assignment, but I mean the concern I think that's expressed is that the injured party is giving up a right that then is being assigned to DHS.
I think we could include that, and perhaps if the DHS people would provide for our review, as raised by Representative McPherson's comments, a copy of the assignments that you now have in force, just to make sure that that's a part of our legislative record also. Somebody can do that for me. I'd appreciate it. Okay, further business before the committee on this issue? Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2146. Ask that you form the group. Let me know who the members are, and if you need legal assistance, we have staff counsel for that. And try to bring this back within a week or 10 days, if we possibly can. Thank you again for your participation. Okay, we're prepared to open a work session on House Bill 2210. Council, explain to us where we are, particularly with respect to amendments.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, you have before you dash two amendments for House Bill 2210. That's the bill that is from the DOJ. It's a housekeeping bill clarifying certain terms and procedures, eliminating inconsistent references and repealing obsolete statutes relating to child support proceedings. The dash two amendments are replacing the dash one amendments. Those amendments specify a time that an obligor has to object to the determination that his or her driver's license should be suspended. Dash 1 amendments had a 14-day time limit. The Dash 2 amendments put in a 30-day time limit. So it's just extending that time limit by 16 days.
Thank you, Council. We'll need a motion on the Dash 2 amendments, which increase the time limit to 30 days. Representative Girard.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 2s into House Bill 2210.
Representative Girard moves the Dash 2 amendments into the House Bill 2210. Is there discussion on the motion? Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2210 are incorporated within the main bill. I need a motion on the bill. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House Bill 2210, as amended, be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Girard moves House Bill 2210 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Discussion? Hearing none, the clerk can call the roll.
Representative Boyd?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2210 is referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Girard as carrier. Close a work session on House Bill 2210 and open a work session on House Bill 2212. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2212 is also a bill from the DOJ. It ensures that child support program will receive personal information from the parties in a child support proceeding. There were Dash 3 amendments that the committee was considering when it first looked at this bill. We have now before us Dash 5 amendments. And those amendments make one change to the Dash 3 amendments. That is, they require that both the obligor and the obligee parent provide personal information about their employers in judgments or orders establishing paternity. The Dash 3 amendments changed the original language of the statute to provide that only the obligor parent had to provide that information. This Dash 5 amendment changes the language back to the original statute to provide that both the obligor and obligee parents must provide that information.
So we need a motion then on the Dash 5 amendments, Council?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2212.
Thank you. Representative Flores moves the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 2212. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Hearing none, that's allowed. On the main motion, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2212 to the floor with a due pass to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Representative Flores moves House Bill 2212 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? You may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2212 is amended as forwarded to the full committee for the due pass recommendation with Representative Flores as carrier, and the work session on that bill is now concluded. We're going to proceed to House Bill 2269, and I'll open a work session on that bill. And as I indicated earlier, we've invited testimony during this work session. The two witnesses would like to come forward from ODOT. My previous discussions with ODOT representatives, I wanted them to bring forth written documentation of their condemnation process and how it gives notice to the owner of property that they will be dispossessed of their possessory rights. As it stands now, we had a bill before us that made the court order on that issue discretionary. We've had some amendments that appeared to make it mandatory. ODOT was referenced in testimony but did not have a chance to make a rebuttal, so this is their opportunity. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is John Guile. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, and specifically I'm the attorney in charge of the section that deals with condemnation litigation. I have a handout, which you should have as a one-page bullet summary. provided copies to the clerk, and I'm going to essentially follow through on this and describe the process briefly. The position of the Department of Justice regarding the pending legislation, either dash one or dash two, is neutral. We're neither for nor against, but I'm simply here to provide some background legal information regarding the present process legally and the present court proceedings available without the bill, and then to describe the projected impact of passing the bill in either form as either optional or discretionary. There are a number of state agencies which use this process, that is condemnation. The condemnation process belongs to the state government as a sovereign entity, and by the way, I'm describing this from the perspective of state of Oregon and state agencies. The primary agency which uses this process is the Oregon Department of Transportation, and Mr. Weigel, who's seated to my right here, will describe how that impacts the Department of Transportation. Other agencies include the Department of Corrections for correctional facilities, the Department of Higher Education for university system buildings, and then the Division of State Lands can step in at any point if other agencies need property to be acquired. Basically, what happens now is there are two things that happen in a condemnation case when the government decides it needs to take property for a public use. The first thing is whether or not the government can take possession and when it can take possession, which is the subject of this bill. The second is the compensation to be paid to the landowner for the taking of the property. Out of all the cases that are handled right now, I'd say that 90% of them are resolved without going to court. Of the 10% that go to court, those 10% almost always involve issues of not possession, which is the bill before you now, but how much money is to be paid, that is compensation. In fact, in the last 9 years, there have only been three cases now in which there's been litigation concerning, at least as to ODOT, concerning the possession of the property. In all three of those cases, there was a court process to follow, the temporary restraining order, preliminary injunction, which is available to landowners to file. And in all those cases, the state won those cases and took possession. So over 99% of this law concerns what is adequate compensation. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Hurley versus Kincaid, has stated that the right to possession is separate from the right to compensation, and the right to a hearing goes with the right to compensation. What the bills before us today would do would be to possibly change the dynamic of what has happened previously as far as the litigation on immediate possession. Dash one amendment would probably have little, if any, effect, although it would provide an optional provision for the government, that is the state agencies and local governments, to go to court and to have a hearing if they chose to have a hearing on the right to immediate possession. The dash two amendments, which would make this mandatory, would probably mean that, for instance, in the case of ODOT, which is our largest customer, basically, in the 50 cases they file each year out of approximately 500 cases, that in every single one of those cases they would have to go to court now in order to get immediate possession. As it presently stands, only one out of 150 cases go to court on that issue. That's one every year and a half, approximately, less than 1%. This would mean that we would have to go to court essentially on all those cases where the landowner triggers that hearing. The impact on the state government would be that in my shop, where I have 10 attorneys working on all issues before my section, two of them are devoted to condemnation cases right now. We would expect there would be an increase in the number of attorneys or full-time equivalents that we would need in order to go to court. We welcome the opportunity to do that since we like to have trial experience, but there would be a fiscal impact of some sort that I'm not here to quantify on the other agencies which pay our bills at a very good rate of $95 an hour, which is much less than the private sector. But in any case, there'd be some sort of fiscal impact to the Department of Justice or to the agencies which pay our bills. There would also be some sort of fiscal impact to the Department of, not to the Department of Justice, but also to the Judicial Department, in that there would be additional court time needed for hearing these cases in the 36 counties in which they hear them. Again, our agency, the Department of Justice, is neutral on this litigation, excuse me, on this legislation, but there would be a fiscal impact in that regard. Finally, what happens in these cases is if the court process in the immediate possession field were to hold up possession of the property through the hearings themselves, through delays in the hearings or setovers, or through appeals, that could cost the state some money as far as delays in construction. On the contract side in my shop, we handle a number of cases involving construction delay cases. Those cases generally involve thousands, hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars in claims. We're generally successful in those cases, but they're very expensive to litigate. And although it's unknown what the impact would be if, in fact, the creation of these mandatory hearings would create more hearings and delays and appeals, there could be increased costs to the state as far as claims from contractors and subcontractors for construction delay cases. I'm here to answer any questions.
Do I have further testimony?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Dennis Weigel with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm with the right-of-way section. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to take you through our process that we have for taking possession of property that we purchase for highway projects and to clear up any misconceptions that you might have regarding how we provide notification to property owners and tenants before we take possession of the property. I prepared a packet for you. Included in the packet is a flow chart that I put together, which shows, kind of outlines our current process for taking possession. And also included in the packet is a copy of each of our written notices that we provide at various stages, which I'll describe in a minute, as well as a couple of informational pamphlets that we have available, which I will also talk about. And that's all put on this large exhibit here if you don't want to be looking at all the papers in front of you. We kind of arranged it all on this exhibit. In a highway project, there are three methods for providing information to the public and to owners and tenants about our process for taking possession. The first of these occurs during the early design of a project, development, when we're holding public meetings and hearings to select the project, to determine the best alternative for a project. At all public hearings, we have available these two informational pamphlets that describe our entire process for acquiring right-of-way, for a highway project, for handling relocation in case anybody has to move because of what we're doing. And in both the pamphlets is a pretty detailed description of what our process is for taking possession and providing notice to the property owners and information about what their rights are before we can do that. The second method that we have is to provide written specific notices at various times during our acquisition of the right-of-way. The first of these occurs at the very start before we've appraised the property. We will send out to all the properties along the line that we're going to affect, to the owners and to any tenants that will be affected by what we're doing, a general information notice. I think that's number one in your packet, along with, again, both these informational pamphlets. We provide a name and a phone number for a contact at our regional right-of-way office in case the individuals have any questions about the process that they're about to go through with us. That's before we've begun the appraisal. The second notice we provide is when we sit down with the property owner after we've completed our appraisal and we present them with a written offer to purchase the property. Included in the written offer is a written notification of our intent to take possession of the property and how we intend to do it. And it would be either upon payment or 30 or more days after the payment for the property, and that depends on what we're acquiring and the impacts that has on the property and on the ownership of the property, which of those we do. That's a written notice given at the time when we first start to negotiate with the property owner. At the same time that we do that, if there are going to be any occupants on the property other than the owners that would have to move because of what we're doing, we provide a separate written notice to those people, which also give them our intention for taking possession. And in the case of relocation, it would be a minimum of 90 days from the date of the letter that we present to the occupant or 30 days after we make payment for the property, whichever is longer. And in no instance could we ever have a property owner vacate property, if a residential owner, if they did not have decent, safe, and sanitary, affordable replacement housing available, regardless of how long that takes. The third written notice we provide is after we've negotiated, we enter into an extensive negotiation with the property owners to purchase the property. And historically now, 92 to 93% of all our property acquisitions, we arrive at a negotiated, agreed settlement for the purchase of the property without going into a condemnation action. At the time we make payment, we provide our second written notice to the owners, which state that either we are taking possession now upon payment as we previously had indicated, or 30 days after the date of the payment, and we provide a specific date that we're going to take possession of the property. At the same time we do that, if there are tenants, occupants that are being displaced by what we're acquiring, we provide them with a separate written notice that we have made a payment for the property and they have 30 days or more if we're still working with them in relocation. Now, on the small percentage of acquisitions that we don't reach a settlement with and we have to enter into a condemnation action, when we file a complaint in court with, we file the condemnation complaint, we deposit into court the full amount of the just compensation that we've arrived at in our appraisal. That's deposited into court for use by the property owners. At that same time, we send them a letter that states we have deposited the money into court. It's available for your use or your attorney's use, and here is our intention for taking possession. If it was indicated it would be immediate, then it would be immediate. We normally, in that instance, will give them a five-day grace period just to make sure they've gotten the letter and everything. But basically, we're saying the money is available. We are taking possession, as we indicated, or it would be 30 or more days in the future. Let's see. Where am I? At that same point in time, again, if there are tenants involved that have to relocate, we provide them a separate written notice at that same time saying we deposited the money in the court and here's your 30-day notice or longer if we're working with them in relocation. So those are the specific notifications that we have to provide during acquisition of property. The third way that we have of working through the whole issue of when we take possession and how we do it is doing negotiations with the property owner. After we've presented our offer to purchase, we sit down with the property owner, we give them the written offer. By law, the property owner has a minimum of 40 days to accept or reject our offer before we could even think of starting a condemnation action. And depending on the schedule that we have for construction, for letting the construction project, most of the time it's longer than 40 days. We work with people months if the construction schedule allows for that before we'll resort to a condemnation. We don't like condemnations. They're not our friend. During those negotiations, we talk with property owners a lot. We meet with them face-to-face. We talk with them by phone. We talk about how much we're offering them. And if they have issues with what we've stated as far as how we're going to take possession of the property, we discuss that with them. And we try to resolve any outstanding issues in that area during the course of the negotiations. So that's the third way that we deal with providing notification and working through issues on taking possession. Now, this process has been extremely, extremely successful. As Mr. Guile has already said, in the past 9 years, there have been only three instances where a court action was required in a condemnation case to resolve the issue of taking possession. Our condemnation cases are always dealing with how much we're going to pay and impacts to the property. The three instances out of approximately 500 condemnation cases that were filed over a 9-year period required our having to go to court to resolve an outstanding issue about taking possession of the property. We've used this process that you see here throughout the history of our department. 30, 40 years, we've always used this process. There has never been an instance before where an attempt was brought before the legislature to try to force a change in our process for taking possession. When we get into a condemnation arena, that's after we've been talking with property owners for several months, by the time we enter into a condemnation process, it's almost 100% that property owners will have retained an attorney by that time. So if there's one area in our entire property acquisition process that would be under scrutiny for there being an outcry if we're abusing property owners' rights, it would be in the condemnation arena, because the property owners have by that time an attorney representing them. So, and that has not happened as far as any action being brought before a legislative body throughout the history of the department to get us to enter into a different mechanism for taking possession of the property that we're acquiring. House Bill 2269 was a consensus bill that was put together by the Eminent Domain Work Group, of which ODOT is one member, along with other public and private members. It described a very good optional judicial process for taking possession, which we support, and quite frankly, which we would use in those 2 to 3 instances every 9 years where we have to resort to a court action to resolve an issue of taking possession. It's a good process. Our Dash 1 amendment, which we brought forward, does nothing to change the substance of that other than to clarify that it's an optional process, and that was the intent of the bill when it was created by the Eminent Domain Work Group. The Dash 2 amendment is the product of one individual on that group who wants to make the process a mandatory process. It did not have the support of the Law Commission or the work group. There are impacts to the department if the process, the Dash 2 amendment, is carried and the bill is passed with that being a mandatory process. We estimate that it would cost the department $60,000 to $120,000 every 2 years for additional legal expenses and staff expenses in filing the motions for possession in court and handling court hearings. A greater concern will be the delays in letting the construction contracts. There will be, if this is a mandatory process, there is no question that there will be a delay in how quickly we can take possession of all the properties we need in order to let the contract. And that means that there's a delay in how long it takes us to take possession, there's a delay in when we can let that contract, and that delays are getting the projects built and the pavement on the road, if you will. And then, as Mr. Giles brought up, our biggest worry is those instances where we may have already started the construction and then something comes up in our resulting in our not being able to get possession when we need it, and that could be an appeal to a court order. And I've got one instance I won't bring up now, but I'll be glad to share if you want to hear it, with the city of Salem, where that very thing happened. The court order was appealed to take possession and just stretched the whole process out. So those are our concerns. That's our process. I thank you for your time, and I'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you again for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you notify a party of a possession, how do you do that? By what process?
When we notify that we're taking possession?
Yes.
At the point we're actually taking possession, it would be either when we, if it's a settlement, if it's not going into a condemnation, it would be when we pay the property owner for the property we're acquiring. We provide a written notice at that point saying we are taking possession now, or we will take possession in 30 days as we agreed upon in the earlier. In a condemnation, it would be when we deposit.
You're not following my question. My question is, how do you notify people? Do you send them regular mail? Do you send it certified? How do you notify the person?
Regular mail. We send them a letter by mail or in person. When we make payment, oftentimes that's in person. In a condemnation action, it's by mail.
Follow?
Yes.
So you have, if that, you have no first-hand knowledge that the person's even getting the notification. You just send out a letter which says on it, cannot be forwarded, and then you hope that the person received it?
Okay. Chair Ackerman, Representative Garrard, we don't have, as far as you're saying, do we have any knowledge they've received the letter? We don't send it certified, so we don't get return receipt, although we did do that for a while, and I don't know the history of when we stopped on that. But at the same time, in a condemnation action, we're involved with the property owner and their attorney in conversations, and they know through long before we've deposited into court that we're depositing in the court, and when we deposit in the court, as we've been extensively discussing with them, we're either going to be taking possession as of that point in time or 30 or more days in the future. So they have a lot of information on that, but in answer to your immediate question, do we know for sure, do they have that letter in hand at a given day? No, we don't.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee of these witnesses? Fine. Thank you very much for your testimony
this morning.
And again, we're in work session, and this is not a public hearing. Mr. Willis, you've testified extensively before, and the only issue that was wanted to just address today were your concerns about ODOT, and they have so spoken, and that's the limitation of the invited testimony this morning. Counsel, could you explain where we are on the bill with respect to the amendments which have been previously submitted?
Yes, first of all, I'll just go through what the amendments are and talk about what we did, what the committee did previously. The Dash 1 amendments would further clarify that the procedure in the bill is optional. The Dash 2 amendments would make the procedure mandatory.
And Dash 1, excuse me?
The Dash 2 Dash amendments.
Mandatory?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then there are Dash 3 amendments. They don't deal with either the optional or mandatory issues with the bill. They merely clarify issues that the court may consider upon defendant's objection. Those bills were brought up. One of the members of the work group pointed out a technical issue, and the Dash 3 amendments addressed that issue. On May 4th, this committee adopted the Dash 2 amendments, which would make the procedures mandatory.
Okay, then the question before the committee is whether to forward it to the full committee with the Dash 2 is already in it, making the process mandatory, or whether we want to back out of that and adopt the Dash 1s, which would re-emphasize the original bill and making the process optional. So I would need a motion one way or the other, either to make it mandatory and to just take a motion because the Dash 2s are already there. If we want to make it go back to optional, what would be the motion, Council?
You'd have to rescind, take out the make a motion to take out the Dash 2 amendments.
And adopt the Dash 1.
And then adopt the Dash 1.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
So the Chair needs a motion one way or the other. So
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to rescind the Dash 2 amendments and substitute into the bill the Dash 1 amendments.
So you want to retain the mandatory process, is that correct?
No, rescind the Dash 2s.
Pardon?
I was making a motion to rescind the Dash 2s.
Oh, rescind the Dash 2s. Okay.
And include the Dash 1s.
Okay, that's nice. That's good. Okay, the motion then by Representative Worth is to rescind the Dash 2 amendments from the main bill and adopt the Dash 1 amendment. Is there discussion on that motion? I'm going to call a roll on this one.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
All right, then, the Dash 2 amendments are rescinded, and the dash one amendments are included within House Bill 2269. And now we'll need a motion to forward to the committee, full committee. Representative Wirth.
And Mr. Chair, are we not considering the dash threes?
Council, do we need the dash threes?
The dash threes, like I said, do not deal with the either optional or mandatory nature. They just make a technical change in the bill. They don't change the substance of the bill. What they do is, one of the commissioners pointed out that they deal with it when a court, what the issues that the court can look at if somebody decides to challenge one of these combinations. The original bill allows for a challenge based on either fraud or abuse of discretion. One of the commissioners pointed out that abuse of discretion action comes up when there's delegated authority. That would happen in agency situations where they have a delegated authority, and then the correct action to bring would be abuse of discretion. So it clarifies that abuse of discretion actions are brought when there's a delegation of authority, and then it includes bad faith, actions for bad faith, which would be similar to abuse of discretion, but would be against a public official that does not have delegated authority.
Would the dash three is a consensus of the work group?
Ms. Johnson is here to answer that. She's indicating that they were a consensus of the work group, and I believe she could further explain the dash threes if that's necessary.
Do you want an explanation?
No, I think that.
Do you want to move the dash threes?
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash threes, dash three amendments.
All right. Representative Wirth moves the dash three amendments into the main bill, House Bill 2269. Is there discussion? Objection? That's allowed. Now we'll need a motion on the before the bill. Representative?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2269 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair? Excuse me.
Do we have any ability to have a discussion
on the motion?
On this bill?
Yeah,
before the motion?
Yes.
I just want to go on record because of history with ODOT notifications that I think they need once again to review the process on their notifications to people, and that their mail, as far as I know at this point, is not forwarded. In other words, if there was a piece of property which you had already vacated and they send the mail to that particular address, it will not follow you. So therefore you, and if you didn't have counsel, you would in essence be dropped out of the process, and that process would continue without your notification or your acknowledgement or agreement. So I just want to point that out. I support the bill, but I certainly have that reservation in regards to ODOT.
All right. I'm sure that you could talk with the ODOT representatives because they came close enough on this bill to make a court order mandatory, and your position is sort of midway between the two positions, so maybe we could discuss that with them and see what they can do administratively to cure that problem. Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call a roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2269, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and be carried by Representative Wirth. And I will then close the work session on House Bill 2269. I mentioned earlier that House Bill 3303 will be held over until Wednesday for an amendment to accommodate PERS. Council, do we have to open a work session, or is that just going to be noticed on the agenda?
That will just be noticed on the agenda.
Okay, then I will not proceed to the work session on that bill. And open a work session on HM4. Work session on HM4.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Memorial 4 request that the Oregon's United States Senators work to ensure the expeditious Senate action on Supreme Court nominations. You have before you dash two amendments. Those amendments take out some of the language of this bill, specifically the term activists, which described the word judges, and it also deletes the phrase deploying deleterious tactics to prevent, and just replaces that with preventing.
Thank you, Council. We need a motion before we can entertain discussion.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash two amendments to House Memorial 4.
All right. Thank you. Representative Flores moves the dash two amendments. Two amendments into the House Memorial. Is there discussion? Hearing none, that's allowed. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Memorial 4 to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Memorial 4 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
No.
Chair Ackerman?
No. Chair Krieger? Going to break a tie?
Aye.
House Memorial, that four as amended is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and a work session on the memorial, House Memorial 4 is concluded. Is there further business before the committee? None, we're adjourned.